It's time to talk about Las Vegas with Ira. Each week, Ira David Sternberg talks with the celebrities, entertainers, writers, and personalities who make Las Vegas the most exciting city in the world. And now, here's Ira.
Jazz is expanding in Las Vegas, and my guest is playing his part this Friday and Saturday. Jason Hainsworth, San Francisco-based saxophonist, composer, recording artist, and most importantly, educator, will be performing with his quintet at Vix Las Vegas this Friday and Saturday, August 2nd and 3rd at 7 and 8:30. For reservations, go to vixlasvegas.com, and for everything about Jason, go to jasonhainsworth.com, and you can follow him on Facebook, Instagram, X, and YouTube. And Jason, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ira. Nice to meet you.
Pleasure. So I think the most important question is, you're expanding because you went from a quartet to a quintet. Is the next an orchestra? I mean, what's happening here?
It is whatever the gig calls for, I guess would be the safe answer for that.
Fair enough.
this particular iteration will be quintet. So I'm looking forward to it.
That's great, because I know you usually are in a smaller group, so that works out fine. Yeah. You went to the High School for the Performing and Visual Arts in Houston, Texas, when you started out, and I'm sure you were actually starting even earlier with music. In fact, before we get to that, when did you become interested in music? Do you remember how early you were, or how young?
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to parents that, you know, really supported the arts and music in particular. So I took guitar lessons at 4, I believe. I think I wanted to be like a rock guitar player. I was really strangely influenced by like the Flying V guitars. When I was a kid, I always wanted one because I saw Kiss as a kid, like on TV and stuff like that. But eventually I grew out of that phase and started playing the saxophone. So saxophone probably around age 8 or 9 years old.
I laugh when you said strangely influenced. I just like that term when you said that. That's what I laugh at. When you decided to focus on the saxophone, were there particular musicians at that point and at that age that you looked up to that were either recording artists or you had seen performing live or on television?
At that particular time, I would say no, but as I got maybe a couple of years older, then I began to be kind of involved in just like, you know, community arts and music organizations and things like that. And Houston during that period was, I would say, fertile ground. And there was always live music taking place. So I could always hear, you know, really good saxophone players that were from Houston that would come back home and play. So Illinois Jacquette, Arnett Cobb, David Fathead Newman, those saxophone players that are part of the Texas tenor saxophone tradition, really kind of, you know, they just played in my neighborhood at neighborhood juke joints and bars and clubs. And I was able to like kind of sneak into that stuff because my brother or my parents would drag me to that stuff. So that kind of sparked an interest in it.
Right. How did you focus? I just want to go back for a second. How did you end up focusing on the sax versus any other musical instrument? What was it that appealed to you? Was it the tone? Was it the overall experience of playing a sax? What was it that drew you?
There's a much simpler answer for that, which is my brother played the saxophone. And then when he quit, my mother said, well, are you going to play the saxophone?
Wait a minute. So that's economics.
Yeah.
I have to buy you another instrument,
yes,
right?
Efficiency would be the best answer for that.
That's great. It seemed to work out. So
it eventually took, you know, it eventually took.
I want to go back to the High School for the Performing and Visual Arts. And that's in Houston, Texas. So Did you know you wanted to go there, or was it later on as you went through school and you practiced more with the sax now that your brother wasn't using it anymore? And so you ended up applying to go there?
Yeah, I went to a a performing arts middle school, and I played in the band, and I was, I guess, pretty serious as much as a middle schooler could be in playing music. And not only playing a saxophone, but I played oboe and I played piano in middle school also. And it was just kind of a logical continuation on that. I think I started to take it a little more seriously. I became somewhat of a band nerd, as many band kids become in middle school, and going to, like, you know, summer music camps and things like that. And I guess over the years, I got more and more serious about it. And I recognized that I wasn't going to be Michael Jordan or Akeem Olajuwon at the time. Started, you know, really listening to more and more music, more jazz music in particular. So I applied, or my parents applied for me to audition, and I got into that school.
That's interesting too, because saxophone, you could go a couple of different ways with the sax, because it's a very versatile instrument. But you chose jazz mostly, and you focused on jazz mostly. Was there one particular reason, or were there a series of reasons why you picked that genre versus you could play in a rock band, you could play in a big band, you know, assuming there's a few big bands left in this economy. But at any rate, what was it that drew you to jazz particularly?
I think there was a couple of reasons. I think one, it was, I think, just listening to the music as a kid, it was the one style of music for me that really sparked an instrument, and I could truly hear the saxophone as a solo instrument. Being kind of at the forefront, not playing in an ensemble necessarily, or not, you mentioned being in a rock band, not backing a vocalist, if you will. Although that happens all the time in jazz music, but like I could hear as a kid someone on the instrument that I was playing as a kid, and hearing like all the cool stuff that, you know, that saxophonist was doing. I was just interested in, how could I sound like that? Or how could I, as silly as it sounds now, how could I play as fast as those guys were playing? Because that just seems unreal to be able to do that. Like, how can they move their fingers so fast? And I can't do it like that. So that's kind of how that started. And then over time, starting to see and hear people live play like that. I remember, you know, just as a kid, hearing Wynton Marsalis and Branford Marsalis playing live in concert, or going to see Joe Henderson, like really, you know, like jazz legends play, and them being nice to me also when I would meet them as like a teenager, and have them spend time with me and show me like tricks of the trade, if you will. That all kind of drew my interest into going in that direction.
How influential was Ellis Marsalis in your development?
I would say he was tremendously influential, just because of, you know, the folks that I previously mentioned, you know, mm-hmm. he being the father of Ellis, of Wynton and Branford Marsalis, and those two guys were heroes of mine. They still are. That really made me want to study with him, just to see what information was he, you know, giving his own kids. And it was one of the primary reasons why I went to the University of New Orleans, was to meet him and to study music with him.
So he did have an impact on you.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And Victor Goines, how about him?
Victor, you know, I when I started at the University of New Orleans, I really was unaware of Victor Goins, but he became almost immediately a mentor of mine and a big brother of mine. And someone really just like, I remember going to the campus one day and him having like a really nice car. And I thought, wow, you can be a jazz musician and have nice things. This sounds great.
Yeah, this sounds counterintuitive there.
Yeah. And you know, he had a nice house and just like you know, adult things. And yeah. I didn't feel like he was like a starving artist, starving musician.
I thought you guys just lived for cigarettes and just, you know.
Yeah. And that was absolutely not the case with him. So like, he really just kind of took me under his wing and drug me to gigs that he was playing at and had me sit in, and I didn't know anything. I was, 18 years old. I barely could play a blues, if that, at that time, but was always encouraging and just giving me like very tough love, but really frank and honest. And he's someone that I still stay in contact with to this day.
It sounds like you were in touch and touched by a lot of people who didn't let ego get in the way and didn't let their own talent blind them to a potential musician at that point.
No, and I think I would like to think that is indicative of just the jazz community in itself. I think one thing that we have going for us as jazz musicians is that it is a very community-minded genre of music, which is how the music was founded. I would say most of the musicians are they go out of their way to invite other musicians. I mean, we have gigs, but we always, ask people to sit in. You can't really do that on a chamber music concert, right. Ask a violist to sit in on second viola. That's not a thing.
Could be.
It could very well be.
Try it out.
That,
see what happens.
That has not happened yet. But there's still more centuries to come.
Right.
I think that's just part of the community minded focus of this music.
When you look at your record, and I'm talking about your educational record, because part of what you do, which is important, is education. But you didn't just go to one school; you went to several before you ended up becoming full time professionally performing, and you're still an educator, obviously, now too, as I mentioned in the beginning. Do you think that amount of time that you spent, because you also you went to New York, New Jersey, and you went to the William Patterson University, so, and you were performing obviously at the same time, but it still strikes me as it's a lot of schooling that you took the time for before you then did it full time, but you're also teaching. So it's in a way it's full circle, but I guess what I'm trying to say in my own muddled way is that you spent a lot of time with musical education before you went full time in terms of performing.
I would say, it's a bit of a balance. I think I'd never made a conscious effort in doing both. They just kind of happened simultaneously. And that also goes back to, the people that we just mentioned, Ellis Marsalis and Victor Goins. Victor was a math major in college. Ellis Marsalis, he had bachelor's and master's degrees music as well. So those and my high school band director, Robert Morgan, he had a doctorate. So those were all just mentors of mine. And at the time, there was something sort of in my head romantic about doing both playing and just learning about the craft. that I was trying to focus on. So in my head, it was not a matter of just going to school to, you know, get these degrees. It was honestly just, I need to get better as a musician. I need to figure out how to play the saxophone better. And one way of doing it that is, you know, going to school and studying with somebody with that's just better at this than me, and you know, kind of honing my craft while I did go out and, you know, venture out into the outside world and play and gig and stuff like that.
Well, the word you used earlier, and I think that's the perfect word, is balance. You're balancing your performing side with your educational side. You're learning all the time and adding then to the performance. And I'm sure the performing side adds value to the educational side, because you can contribute things in a classroom setting or in a study session with an instructor that you picked up on the road.
Right. Absolutely. I think they lend itself to both worlds. So I don't think I would be a good educator if I did not have the experience of traveling the world or performing outside of, you know, school, because the information that I'm learning as I'm leading a band or as I play as a sideman on any of these, you know, tours or shows, that's valuable information that my students need to know, because I teach at a conservatory now. So the goal of most, if not all, of my students is to become a professional musician that is doing that very thing. So I need to be able to tell them what to do and what not to do in those professional type settings.
Does your performing also inform your composing?
Oh, absolutely. I would say that's probably the best best recipe for learning is, and I think back to, you know, like, I think learning composition in a school sometimes can be antiseptic. And especially on the jazz side, that's not historically how that took place, right? Like, if you're thinking about Miles Davis or Count Basie or Billy Strayhorn and Duke Ellington, those guys, they wrote constantly even while they were on the road, and they tried things out on the road, and the things that didn't work, they took that as a lesson to not do it again. So that same type of stuff, I think, influences me. Especially when I'm in different settings, whether it's jazz or not, for that matter, kind of help me be a better composer, a better editor of my own stuff, I think.
I could see how that could work on the road, because you would get instant real world feedback from the audience if you tried something out. And
absolutely, from the audience and from the musicians, like,
yes, right.
Theoretically knowing how high a trumpet player can play is very different from the practical side of how high a trumpet player can play, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Especially if maybe that this is the seventh tune of a set. You can't, you know, have a trumpet player screeching. They're going to be mad at you, and they're going to curse you out. And they're going to, you know, they just won't be happy. So
then your quartet becomes a trio.
Right. Exactly.
They're on their way out the door, because how dare you do that to me? That could work. So you've got all these things that you balance, because you've got the education, composing, performing, and it has to be at one point stimulating, and at the same time, not stressful, but it's a heavy workload, I would think.
Yeah, you know, it's a heavy workload, but in reality, you know, I'm not digging ditches or,
you know. Understood.
Yeah. I'm not a construction worker. So, like, this is this is all fun. Like, making music is fun.
Right.
Even teaching class, that's still fun. You know, I have fun students. So it could be, and I get to travel for free to like perform and make music in front of an audience or in front of other students. So it's big pictures. This is really easy.
You're not digging ditches in the noonday sun.
No.
Yeah, I got you. You mentioned your students and traveling. Do you ever get a situation where you've traveled to another state, for example, and perform, because you travel all over the United States and perform. And do you ever get a situation where you're performing and either a former or current student comes up to you after the performance and you didn't know they were there?
Have that? I'm sure that, yes, that has happened. Probably as I get older and older, it happens more and more often. And it takes me a second to recognize them, because they're old now too, and they probably have kids themselves, and it's always great, you know. Like it's actually, I have a student that was my very first student when I graduated from when I first started teaching full time, and he is about to turn 30 now, and he texted me saying that he is going to be in town tomorrow and he's playing at a club here. So like that stuff is like really crazy to me.
Well, it shows you also that the influence you had on them too, the fact that they're still in touch with you and they want you to come see them perform if you can do it. And also, I think too, because you teach so many different students, I would think that if you were in another state and performing and somebody came up to you and you hadn't seen that student in 10 years, and like you said, they've grown up, they have kids of their own, and you've gone through a lot of students over the years, it's hard to immediately recognize their name or their face unless they tell you. And then, you know, that's fine. So,
well, the ones that were good students, I usually recognize.
Okay, great. Yes. Genius recognizes genius. I get it. let's talk a little bit about your performance, your upcoming performance. Again, this Friday and Saturday, August 2nd and 3rd, at 7 and 8:30 at Vix Las Vegas. Do you know what you're going to be doing yet there, or are you still working on it?
That's a great question. I have no earthly idea.
How about an unearthly idea? How do you have any alien ideas?
I mean, you know, this is, I think, the unique part of being a jazz musician is that, again, it's a community-minded thing. So I'm going to have a conversation with the band. I'll probably have a text chain with the band members. I have not met, I don't think, any of the band members yet. I think we're all flying in the same day. We'll have a text chain about songs that everyone likes or feels comfortable playing. And we'll show up and count the tunes off, and it'll be fun, and it'll be an exciting experiment for the audience and for the performers.
Absolutely. I looked up a thesaurus of jazz, and under jazz it said living on the edge, so I think that's what you're doing.
Yeah, but you know, it is a crafted chaos.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
Crafted Chaos, CC, instead of
yeah.
But let's take it from your point of view, though. When you have this text change going on, are there one or two songs that you absolutely would like to perform, tune that you just think this has got to be in the selection?
No,
you're very flexible. I like that.
Yeah,
some people are a little bit more dogmatic than
I think, you know, like we kind of have a repertoire that's kind of built into the community.
It's baked into the DNA.
It's built into the DNA. Like we probably have to play a blues just because that's like home base for us. Right. Mm-hmm. Anything after that, I'm really cool with. So It could go in any direction, and that blues could go in any direction for that matter as well. So I'm not terribly worried about that. And that's part of the fun, and it's really a good way to get to know the other musicians as well, to right. see what songs they're comfortable playing, and also it kind of informs me of maybe some songs that they know that I don't know, and maybe I should know them. So mm-hmm.
It's part of that education of yours, isn't it?
Part of the education. Yeah. So maybe I need to learn these tunes, and I'll try to practice them and see if we can play them.
How important is, and I always bring this up because it's always there, the Great American Songbook. How much of that is a foundation for jazz and for you in particular?
It's a part of the DNA of the genre as well. And that goes back to just Branford Marcellus would talk about just like the carefulness of the melodies in those songs, which is a key ingredient to connecting with the audience. So those songs from, I would say, anywhere from the 30s to the mid to late 50s. Mm-hmm. I'm talking, I'm hearing all of these Sonny Rollins songs or recordings in my head, because he was just famous for playing, you know, There's No Business Like Show Business, or, just kind of like cheesy songs otherwise, but like the way that he would play them would mm-hmm. be, you know, beautiful. Or Surrey with the Fringe on Top.
You're right, from Oklahoma. Yeah.
From Oklahoma. Like that's not a jazz song.
But no,
like,
it's not.
but he recorded that in like 1957 or 58. I know that song, you know, or On the Sunny Side of the Street, you know, right. just like, Dizzy Gillespie and Sonny Stitt and Sonny Rollins recorded that in the 50s, I believe. So those are just great songs that we should know and we should be able to play.
Well, before I let you go, a very important question, which is your brother still upset about the fact that you succeeded with the saxophone?
No, he's not upset anymore. I still have one of his saxophones. Do I have it here? No, I don't have it. I have it at my home.
Oh, okay.
He's always been like a big supporter of mine.
Oh, good. Okay, so yeah. He's not holding any grudges.
No grudges.
Okay, great. Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Jason Hainsworth, San Francisco-based saxophonist, composer, recording artist, and educator. He's going to be performing with his quintet at Vic's Las Vegas this Friday and Saturday, August 2nd and 3rd at 7 and 8:30. And for reservations, go to vicslasvegas.com. For everything about Jason, go to jasonhainsworth.com. And you can follow him on Facebook, Instagram, X, and YouTube. And Jason, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. See you next time.
You've been listening to Talk About Las Vegas with Ira. Each week, Ira David Sternberg talks with the celebrities, entertainers, writers, and personalities who make Las Vegas the most exciting city in the world. Be Las Vegas. Anything you want us to be. Brace your fantasy. LV. When you